top secret. For senior officer. Immediate. Decipher and pass to all relevant sections. 27th of March. Intelligence Insight, number 001.
Hello, this is Mark, the producer of the Bletchley Park podcast. Currently, Bletchley Park has had to close as a precautionary measure to help contain the spread of the coronavirus. And like many of you, our staff and volunteers are either in lockdown or self-isolation, or you know, many of them are working from home even. But while we can, we're going to continue producing our normal podcasts. But also, myself and the podcast team decided that it would be nice if we could bring you something every week for the next few weeks at least. What we're going to do is every Friday, you'll receive a new episode from us. So it will either be one of our normal Bletchley Park podcast shows that we already had planned. And in between those, we're going to do, as you may have heard in the new intro, extra shows called Intelligence Insight. What we're planning to do with these shows is, with the 8 years of content we've got, we're going to bring you some gems from previous episodes, probably based on a theme, but we're also going to bring you some content that you won't have heard. There's a few things that we just didn't have a chance to put out at the time. So you will get some exclusive content as well. So for this very first episode, I've decided to bring you what for me personally were probably five of the most memorable interviews. The first of these is a lady called Wynne Ribchester, who I interviewed very early on in the podcast back in 2012. Now, Wynne has quite a unique story to tell because she was at Bletchley Park during World War II, but she wasn't serving at Bletchley Park. She was living there as a schoolgirl. I wonder if you could start by telling us how you actually ended up living here in the first place and when you moved here.
Well, in January 1938, my father came down here to work, and he said that we would move down here to live after the end of the summer term of school. So he worked here, and he used to commute back to Twickenham, where we lived. And we came and we moved into Number 2 Cottage, as it is now, in 1938, and we stayed here until 1942.
So when you first moved here, was this prior to the codebreakers moving in, or had
some of them already? Oh, yes, rather. I mean, he showed us around the house, and I didn't like it. It was spooky. It was empty, not a stick of furniture anywhere, but lots and lots of electric cable where they're obviously rewiring. And on the floor of every room, there were telephones about to be installed. In those days, telephone handsets were always black, but as we went around, I noticed some were green, and in some of the principal rooms, some of them were actually red. And there was just nothing in the place whatsoever. We went down to the kitchen, and the only thing in there was the workman's tea, sugar and milk, you know, that stuff. And I didn't go into the mansion again until after the war had started, when I had to go in and be interviewed for, you know, security reasons.
When you were interviewed, is this true that you signed the Official Secrets Act?
Oh, yes, completely true.
What age were you when that happened?
13.
Were you given a stiff talking to, or was it just a nice
interview? No, it was rather funny, really, because my father really hammered it into us. You must not talk about anything. Well, he met me at the gate, and I thought, what the devil does he want? And he said, oh, some people want to talk to you. So we went into the mansion. I couldn't believe it. It was absolutely buzzing. Telephones, teleprinters, clattering noise, typewriters. And it was interesting because on all the doors, there were little plaques with numbers and letters on, no names. We went up to the first floor, and he pushed me into this room and said, there's some people want to talk to you. I'll wait out here. No explanation. And I went in and I was confronted by a long table going from side to side, covered in a grey army blanket. Seated at the table, there were three very high-ranking officers, one from each of the services. In front of each man was a brand-new, unused notepad and a pencil and his service cap. And it amused me faintly because every peak of the service caps were pointing in the same direction, all very military. And the man in the middle was army. I think he was a colonel. And he set off by saying, you know, name and all that stuff. And then he said, when you're at school, do the other children ask you what's going on here? Oh, I said, yes, all the time. And they all leaned forward rather anxiously and said, and what do you say? So I said, well, it's just a lot of civil servants from London. Because that's what my father said, you know, you mustn't say anything else. So that seemed to satisfy them. And then he said, are you ever approached by grown-ups or on the train or in the town? I said, no. And that was it. And then he made a great long speech about how important Bletchley Park was and that it was absolutely vital that nothing should be discussed or given away at all. And he really hammered this point home. And then he fished into his briefcase and put out a document in front of me and said rather solemnly, this is the Official Secrets Act. I could see that because it was on the top. And he said, it's a solemn pledge, a solemn promise, because this place has got to be kept very secret. And he went on and on. And then he handed me a very, very posh fountain pen. And he said, you must write your name in capitals there and then sign it and date it. So I did that. And he said, thank you for coming. And I went to join my father. And as I went out, I heard someone chuckle. And I was a prickly little devil, actually. And I said, they're laughing at me. He said, no, they aren't. He said, they're laughing because you're the youngest ever to sign the OSA. Because I was 13. And, you know, they needn't have bothered. It was obviously very, very heavily stage managed to impress a schoolgirl. But, as I said, I'd had it dinned into me, my father, so they were, you know, it was really a bit of a rain dance.
I believe there's a story about you and the daily passwords.
Oh, God, that was awful. Well, what happened was they had this, well, now I think of it, it was a daft system. When the big steel fence went up with the barbed wire on the top, which incidentally incorporated a much, much bigger area than the original little crude wooden fence, and they had these passwords. Well, they were changed at 8:30. And I caught my train at 8:30 to school. It was one station up the line. And so when I came in the afternoon, I never knew it. And the people on the gate used to say, oh, hello, and how are you? Good day at school, you know, chatty like that. And then they would march me up to the mansion for formal identification. And I said, look, this is ridiculous. You know who I am. And I would go up to the mansion, and my name would be written in the book, the time of arrival, and that was it. And I really got fed up with this. And I said, why do you do this? You know that I live here. You know who I am. It is procedure. But it didn't last long. We had passes after that. It was much easier.
Jean Cheshire, who's one of our volunteers, also lived here during the war. Can you tell me how you first met her?
Well, Jean's father and my father were close friends. And I remember him coming round our house looking decidedly shaken because there were no scans in those days. And he said, I've got two daughters. And I finally met Jean when she was about 10 days old. And I reminded her of it recently, and she said, 10 days old? She said, I don't remember that.
What did you think of the people who were working here?
Oh, well, it depended who they were. We had billetees, and we had two sorts. We had two who were with us for about a year and a half, one after the other, not together. And they were terribly indiscreet, and they would talk about anything. I think they felt that if, since they were on station, it didn't matter. One of them was a squadron leader in the RAF, and I kept hearing him and his chums talking about something. And I said to him, what is this? Oh, he said, that's called RDF. So I said, well, what's that? And he said, it stands for radio direction finding. So I said, well, what's that? And he said, well, you fire a radio beam up into the sky, and if there are aeroplanes up there, the beam is reflected back to England. And he said, and there are RDF listening stations all around the coast. I mean, terrible saying all this. I said, well, what good does that do? So he said, well, they can tell from the echoes how many aeroplanes, their height, their direction, and their range. And how many there are. So I said, it's marvellous. He said, yes, and it's all very secret, so you keep your mouth shut. which of course I did. And of course that was later known as radar. And then we had a whole lot of abilities who were, I used to privately call them my flybynights. And they would come from don't know where, and they would stay 3 days, a week. And I noticed that they never went out of the park, and they spent all their time in the mansion. And they didn't work shifts, they did sort of office hours, and then they were gone. And they were very nice and very friendly, and they used to tell me all about the theatres and the art galleries and museums that I would see after the war. And they never talked down to me. They never patronised me or anything. And I liked them all very much, actually. And that 4 years, believe you me, I had to grow up.
What was it like, I mean, just generally being a child? I mean, could you play in the grounds at all?
No, and I couldn't have any visitors. I never had a birthday party or a birthday tea, and I never had friends in to play with me. They just were not allowed. And one Saturday, a couple of my chums came up to the park and said, oh, can we go in and see when you see? And they were told in no uncertain terms to push off. So all my friendships were very one-sided. I could see them, but they couldn't see me. So it was lonely, really. But you just put up with things as a child, don't you? You adapt.
Did you ever get a chance to talk to your parents about what was actually happening here after the war, sort of years later?
No, my father never said a word. And when we went back to Twickenham to live, and I said, well, where are you working? And he said, I'm working in London. End of conversation. And that was that.
Thank you so much, Wynne.
You're very welcome.
All of our veterans will have signed the Official Secrets Act when they started working for GCNCS, and they didn't talk about what they did for at least 30 years. And we still have veterans now who still won't talk about it, and we absolutely respect their decision to do that. Now, sometimes they do suddenly decide they want to talk about it, and this interview from 2015 with a lady called Flo Cole is the perfect example of that. Flo, first of all, told me she wasn't sure if she wanted to do an interview because she hadn't really spoken about what she'd done in the war. Another veteran who we'd previously recorded came over and basically said to her, oh, it'll be fun, why don't you do it? And that kind of convinced Flo. So what you hear now is Flo talking about what she did during World War II for the first time. And what you won't hear is, by the end of the recording, Flo, bless her, was gripping my hand really tight because it was a real release for her. After we finished recording, she actually said to me she hadn't ever spoken to anyone about it. The really nice payoff for this is a few weeks after this, I spoke to Flo on the phone and she was rushing off because she had to go and do an interview on her local radio station. So she's now found that she can and wants to talk about what she did.
There we go. And do you like to be Florence or Flo?
Flo.
Flo.
Everyone call me Flo.
I'm sat here now with Flo Cole, who was a WAF. And I see from your badge, you were at Chicksands. When did you join up or were you called up?
1943, but I was called up.
Did you pick the WAF?
Well, it was a bit difficult at the time because I'd got two brothers in the RAF, which were called up. And I was very upset when I had to go to be registered. And all they could offer me was to be in the army. Oh, dear, I thought. Strangely enough, I just said, oh, I can't go in the army. My brothers are in the Air Force. So this particular person that was interviewing me, she said, well, I'm sorry, you've got to go in the army. I said, I'm sorry, hang on, I've got to go home and ask my mother whether... And when I got home, my mother said, definitely not the army. You've got to go and follow your brothers.
Well, your brothers wouldn't have let you live it down, would they?
Oh, dear. I was really scared.
Yeah.
Because I thought, oh, my gosh, if I don't do this. So I said to my mother, could you come with me? Because I was scared. She said, oh, don't be silly. Just go back and tell them your mother has told me to tell you that you can't go in the army. And I went back and she said, oh, it's you again. And I said, yes. I said, you better change pretty quick. I'm not going in the army. I've got to go. My mother's told me. I can always remember. Anyway, the outcome of it all is I did go in the Air Force.
But it was fun in those days.
So did you have basic training first?
Oh, yes. I went to Innsworth Lane in Gloucester, did my initial training, and it was one of the hottest summers you could imagine in 1943. I can always remember I was kitted out with full gas equipment on the parade ground, one of the hottest days we'd had for months, and I could feel myself just going over, thinking. I landed on the floor, and all I could hear in the distance was, "Pick that woman up." It was really fun, but serious.
Yeah. And what age were you then? 17, half, 18?
No, I was 20.
Oh, 20?
And from there, I went to 617 Squadron, the Dambusters. Yes. Admin.
Yeah.
And it was sad, really, because I went in the August of 43, and of course, Guy Gibson and all his, a lot of them were killed.
Yeah.
Well, 55,000 to date.
From Bomber Command, yes.
But I didn't stay there very long, but it was interesting, really interesting. And I stayed in the dearest little village in Lincoln called Dunholme Lodge. It was a sweet little place, but I wasn't there that long. Then I left there, went on a course at Cranwell, and I passed out there, and there I am at Chicksands Priory as a codebreaker.
Were you specifically interviewed to do that course, or did they pick you out?
Yes, but it was a slow process, you see. Because I'd passed my initial part of being a codebreaker, then when I got on, I was in a position where I'd come through it all, and I was then ready to take on Chicksands Priory, because I got through my exams, you see.
Yeah.
And I'd be, yes, because I ended up there.
So when you got to Chicksands, what was the work you were doing at Chicksands?
Well, all the messages came in from the wireless telegraphists in code. We typed in code, sent it to, well, the courier used to be there to take it all to Bletchley Park. I was a telepitch operator, yes.
That's what I wanted to know. I mean, did you know when you went in to start doing those courses what it would lead to? No.
It's awfully difficult. I've tried so hard over the years to try and impose what I feel then and still remember. We were living in another world, really and truly. I find it difficult.
I don't think people today understand how all-encompassing that war was, not just for people serving, but for people at home, on the home front. Everyone was involved, weren't they?
But when I went home on leave, my mother never asked me what I did, and I never told her.
Hush, hush.
It was very strange, because you'd have thought one of the family would have said, "Well, what were you doing?" No, never.
To this day, I've still not heard a veteran say one of their family members, apart from saying, "Oh, what are you doing?" The first time, maybe, and the veteran say, I can't tell you.
It's strange.
It was a different attitude, wasn't it?
It's a different world. And we live for the day. We never thought of tomorrow.
No.
That was the time we were living in. And it was a really slow process. We weren't going, although I went from place to place, but it wasn't rushing here, there and everywhere. It was, once again, I find it difficult to express myself. But all I can say is totally different world. And then when I went home on leave, and I'm Birmingham born, we were right by the BSA Canal.
Mm.
We lived not far, half a mile. And then when I went home on leave, the bombing was terrible. I put up with all that and thinking I was going to have it a bit quiet. But no, it was still more so being among all the bombing. But it was accepted because we were at war. And also, in the war, this might not be of interest to you, but we used to have chandelier bombs. They were like a chandelier. One evening, I was home on leave, and we had to go in this shelter in the garden. And there were 12 in that particular shelter. Mm. And one of these bombs, a 13-gallon oil bomb, fell at the back of the 3 shelters. And it was frightening because we were stuck there, and finally the bomb disposal men came, and we went, the nearest place to keep us safe was where the nuns were, which was only about 10-minute walk, and we went down in this crypt, all of us, yes, and they fed us, and the very next night it was bombed to the ground. So do you call that luck?
I think you're very lucky.
I think we were.
But I suppose going home and seeing that, because a lot of veterans we have felt at the time, you know, they couldn't see what they were doing, how that was helping the war.
That's very true.
But, you know, you could go home, see that that bombing was happening and know that you were doing something that was was helping.
But when I think back now, it must have been very important. But I've always thought it wasn't.
That's the thing. All of you are so modest.
Well, all these years, I've always felt, yes, I did that. But I've never considered myself important enough to talk and say, I did this or I did that. No, I've been very quiet about it for the last 70 years.
So many of you have. Mm. That's the reason why people now are so in awe of our veterans, because they can't believe that you could do that for 70 years. And every single one of you was important. Every single one of you was a tiny cog in this big machine. From the most famous code breaker down to the tea girl, everyone was important.
I suppose you're right, but I've never felt I was very special or anything like that because, you know, I don't know. It's just part of the way I feel about it all.
You're all so similar. I haven't heard one bragging veteran ever. You're all so modest.
What a strange thing.
And all I can say is thank you for your service.
Oh, how kind of you to say that. I can look back now and feel, yes, maybe we did contribute a little bit.
Well, you definitely did. And
thank you.
The annual reunions are just a great day for our veterans. They get to see friends that they haven't seen probably for a year, you know, people that they may have known for 75 years. We also have veterans who get to meet new friends. Mary Watkins and Betty Webb both did their service in the ATS, and in 2018 it was the 80th anniversary of the ATS, but neither of them knew each other while they were serving at Bletchley Park. And in this interview you just get to hear two ladies who didn't know each other suddenly become friends. It's brilliant.
To meet in the 1990s. Lots of us were going there, but mark you, it's partly age where they, you know, may have passed on. And it was such a friendly thing. It was my, I told you, my university. So it was that sort of atmosphere.
Yes.
If you ever met them afterwards, you felt this is like my university. I went to college after I came out of the forces, but the army training and being with the others, I consider it more my university.
I quite agree with you, Mary. Mm. I've always considered this to be my university because I never aspired to anything more than that.
No, I didn't really aspire, but because of Bletchley Park, I got the chance. I would never have got the chance without I'd been here.
That
was my, not inspiration, but my chance.
Yes.
Because after the war, I had no difficulty at all in getting good jobs. Whereas before the war, hadn't a chance. I was exploited before
the war. It's interesting that you say that because I found it quite difficult being interviewed by prospective employers after the war when I had to say, I'm sorry, I can't tell you I've been doing. Because then they sort of closed up. And
but they were intrigued. When I went for a job at Fulham Borough Council, for instance, when he said, what did you do during the war? And I said, well, I'm afraid I can't tell you. But it was all clerical. All would be useful with what you're asking for me. And then immediately they gave me an IQ test, which we didn't know much about IQ tests then. When I passed, he said, when did you get your degree? I said, I haven't a degree. So he said, well, I suggest you get something on paper as soon as you can. And that's why I trained to be a teacher.
Oh, right.
I thought I had something on paper.
Yes, well, I'm sure that was necessary because I went to secretarial college.
Yeah. That was the thing to be
Government. I didn't have to pay for it, fortunately.
You didn't?
No, I didn't. It was in London. It was fairly extensive in that terrible winter of 1947.
Yes,
but no, I think the fact that we were here was a good stepping stone, wasn't it?
Oh, well, it was in actual fact, even though you didn't say that you were
a Bletchley Park. Right.
Oh, the very fact, well, it must be that it made us brighter being here. That's what I like to think.
Absolutely. That, well, I think being here was an education in itself.
Exactly, so that you're not so diffident when they ask questions because you felt you could cope with it.
That's right. But the fact that there was such a cross-section of the community here...
That's what you want in life.
Yes. I mean, I met people here that I would never have met otherwise.
No. And same for me.
Yes. Stood me in very good stead. Mm. No doubt about that.
We've just been listening in on two lovely ladies who both served in the ATS. Now, could you both just introduce yourselves for me?
Yes, well, my name is Betty Webb, which was Betty Vine-Stevens when I was actually employed at Bletchley. And I was in the ATS, but that didn't mean very much because once here, you were just assigned to a department and the fact that you were in a service didn't really mean very much. We just jogged along with the rest of our colleagues, whether or not they'd been in the ATS or the RAF.
I'm Mary Watkins. And I was at Bletchley Park during the war, and I worked mainly with other civilians. I was in the ATS, but the people I worked with were called computers in those days, in the way that typists used to be called typewriters, and that's how they did it with the computers. And I worked with these civilians, and I worked with the same group more or less all the time I was here. We worked in London, Caxton Street, to start with. And bit by bit, the contingent was moved as a whole body, first to Leicestershire, an outpost there. What was it called?
Bow Manor.
Was that Bow Manor?
Bow Manor Park. And that was the loveliest part of my career because it was like having a good clerical job and being looked after by orderlies.
So holiday.
Now, you can imagine what fun that was to go and be taken care of. Then we were moved here. Here was not so pleasant because of the shifts.
Oh,
I had
yes.
to work 9 till 8, 8 till 4, 4 till
four
midnight.
4 to midnight, yes.
And the body cannot put up with that.
No.
You had a day off at the end of the week.
If you were lucky.
Exactly the same work, but you were at little pokey huts. Little pokey huts, and you never know if it's a hut for four people or for several, but you couldn't intermingle, not even with the other people.
Oh, no, absolutely
that
not.
That was really so hard to be, you know, to find it like that. But the best part of my life was my service career.
Yes.
We've got an anniversary coming up for the ATS.
Yes.
Now, Betty, you're very much behind this, aren't you? What anniversary have we got coming up?
This is the 80th anniversary of the formation of the Auxiliary Territorial Service.
I mean, we find this with anyone who served in any branch, that they're very proud of their branch. But I think especially you ATS girls are very proud of being ATS ladies,
aren't
you? Oh,
absolutely, yes. Yes, because some of us still are. I'm still a member of the WRAC Association, which I brought up at the meeting earlier on. And it's a wonderful thing to be connected with. It was a tremendous camaraderie.
I've always been a club person.
Yes.
So it was, to me, it was ideal to be with other people in the club. I was a guide when I was young, and it was a continuation of the guides to me.
Yes, you know. I can understand that, yes.
Did both of you have similar training? So what was your basic training?
The basic training? Well, would you like to fire first?
I moved when I was young from Chelsea, where I was born, to Margate. And quite frankly, I never had a chance to take the scholarship exam.
Right.
And because of that, When I got to my Margate Elementary School, they put me 11-year-old with the 14-year-olds because, sounds braggy, but because my ability was to the 14-year-olds, but emotionally, I wasn't a 14-year-old. So it didn't really work. But I made up my mind, knowing that I'd missed my chance, that I would do all I could to do it on my own. So when I left school, I applied to go to night school, and they said, how old are you? When I said 14, they said, you should be at school. Now, I couldn't tell them. My parents had fallen on hard times, and I had to go to work. I know I'm making that a bit of a sob story, and I suppose it is in
a
way.
Well, it's your story.
It's my story.
Yes.
And so I waited till I was 16. Then I went to evening class, did all I could after to catch up on the time that I'd missed when I was young. And to be absolutely truthful, I spent the rest of my life trying to catch up what I missed when I was young.
What was your basic training like when you joined up?
Oh, that was very interesting. We did all the... nothing to do with the work here. It was country dancing, lectures, talking about ENSA, the education thing. But we did have to write, why did you join the army? And I did make an impassioned plea about how hard it was for a girl to do anything in early 1940, and how I was so pleased that now something had come along where I could work and I could do something to show my worth. And I think that impassioned essay that I wrote, that's why I think I was chosen. Truly, I know that sounds a bit odd, but I think that's the only thing I can think. And of course, when I got in, they asked me things like crosswords, which I always loved, quizzes, how soon can I get the telegraph? They asked me all those things. And of course, I could say the right thing. They also asked me something that you didn't do at elementary school. They said, had any languages? I said, well, I've only got schoolgirl French. But they accepted that, schoolgirl French. But I was keen to learn, I must tell you that.
And what about your training, Betty?
My training at the Royal Welsh Fusilier Depot in Wrexham was jolly hard work, physical work. We had to learn how to march, how to wear our uniforms properly, and how to address our superiors. I can't remember the length of it, but at the end of the training, which included gas mask drill, which was hell, because they used to put us into a small room with gas. We wore the obviously military gas masks, and in this exercise we were put into this small room, and the gas masks were to be taken off while they sprayed some gas so that was impressed upon you that you don't disregard a gas warning. And it was horrid, and I think that's why I've still got a funny thread, but that's another story.
I've heard you in the past talking about the uniforms. Now, how bad were they?
When we first had them, they hadn't even a belt round them. They were plain in 40, and then they improved them by giving a belt to it. But the bad thing was they had stockings the colour of mustard. The most comfortable stockings you've ever met. They were fashion, but the colour was terrible.
Colour was awful, wasn't it? And they were terrible. Very thick.
Very thick,
yes.
And awful. And the more you watch them, the more horrible the colour became.
Too right, yes. But I think the worst part of the uniform issue was the knickers.
Oh, yes.
Because they were so long that you either
passion
had
crushers, fashion crushers,
fashion crushers. But you see that they were so big that you either had the top up around your armpits, or if you had round your waist, the rest of it was
ankles.
Down round your knees. Having said that, they were suitable for all weathers, I think, really, weren't they?
They were good quality clothes.
Oh, good quality. A little rough, but good quality.
Is it nice that you can get together here and meet fellow members of the ACS?
Yes, absolutely wonderful. I mean, it's another life, really, that we had then. And it's another life which people, you understand, but an awful lot of younger people don't.
No.
They can't envisage
younger
it.
Younger people can't. They talk a different language. The past is a foreign country. and we're the past.
Yes, that's right. Some of them want to know, but the young generally can't envisage how it was.
Well, I suppose it's so alien to them. We do get a lot more people now are fascinated with, you know, World War II in general. And
yes,
especially the more that the story is told about Bletchley Park through different medium, like The Imitation Game, but all different ways, more interest we get here and the more we can tell the real story, your stories.
Yes, that's right.
I think
right.
That's what's important.
My granddaughter is particularly interested. You never bore her with telling her about it.
No, I never get bored listening to you ladies at all.
No, you're marvellous the way you soak it up.
And you two hadn't met before today?
No, I don't think so. No. I hope we meet next year.
I hope we will, yes. That would be lovely, yes.
Well, ladies, thank you very much and happy birthday to the ATS.
Yeah, thank you.
Absolutely, yes. We had a fantastic day at Ulrawas. That was celebrating the 80th anniversary of the ATS. And I was honoured by having to read the warrant of 1938. We had a service and that was part of it.
Brilliant.
It was brilliant. Yeah.
Well, thank you both for your service.
We'd do it again, wouldn't we?
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
It was a very cold and foggy January morning in 2015 when we launched Mixmas, Debs of Bletchley Park book. On the day, we had seven of the veterans who'd been featured in the book, and they did a Q&A with all of the press that were there. And it was a really successful day, and all the ladies loved it. I've selected Marigold Freeman Atwood from that day just because Marigold seems to have had a whale of a time during World War II. And she's so full of joy about what she did and very proud of what she did, as she should be. Seven of you here today is absolutely amazing. And how did it feel for you today?
Very interesting and very surprising, because mostly old people just feel old. You're like an old chair or something, you know. There's nothing specifically wonderful about being old.
It's probably a surprise for you that people half your age
are
so fascinated by something that you did 70 years ago.
It is extraordinary, it is. But it is one of the things you remember when you're feeling very low, that there was a moment when, even if I'd been a hopeless wife and a lousy mother, there was one moment when I did something which was really useful.
Oh, without doubt. I mean, we say this to every single veteran we speak to, and so many of you say the same thing: I didn't do anything important.
No.
Every single one of you was important, because you were all one tiny cog
in this
big, massive machine.
That's it, yes.
I mean, for you specifically, the big machine,
that's quite real,
because you were one of the first computer operators in the world,
absolutely,
weren't you?
Absolutely, absolutely. Can't work the oven at home.
Well, you didn't need to. You've been there, seen that, done it. You couldn't have known what you were doing would have such consequences, really,
no,
I suppose.
No.
I mean, did you realise at the time, obviously, that you were doing something really important?
Oh, without doubt, because where I worked in the Newmanry, and Professor Newman was a very distinguished Cambridge professor, he believed in giving you at least the impression that you were being kept in their confidence, and that we were being told stuff. And I'm sure we were never told anything really dangerous, but he did hold regular meetings to say what the result of the messages that we'd netted had been in terms of damage to the enemy.
You said about this in the press conference
earlier,
didn't you? And that's the first I've ever heard of that.
Yes, that is true. I promise you that is true.
Oh, no, I believe you. I mean, was it quite general, or was it quite specific at times?
No, I think mostly general. But I do seem to remember the sinking of those two ships. But it could have been something I'd heard. As I say, I haven't looked up the dates. But there were these two German battleships, I think the Scharnhorst and the Gneisenau, they were called. But of course, as you know, a lot of the material we got couldn't be used, as in the evidence of Crete, which you will have heard about, yes.
So when did you first come to Bletchley?
I came straight from university, and I suppose it was about 1943. It must have been, yes.
And did you join up or were you drafted?
No, I was made to... I'd just come down from Oxford and I wanted to do something interesting in the Foreign Office. But my mother said, it's time you had some discipline. And she thought I'd meet a better class of person if I joined the Wrens than if I joined...
Well, I should imagine the Wrens gave you some discipline because it wasn't an easy life as a Wren. Were you in Woburn Abbey?
Yes, I was.
It wasn't the Stokely home it is now,
well
was
wasn't.
It?
No, we had a lot of fun. And I think I've already narrated to somebody how the senior officer gave me her uniform to take to the cleaners. This was too much of an opportunity. I put it on and greyed my hair with talcum powder and stalked round the abbey running my finger along things and telling the cooks their food was disgusting, they must do better on all their better ingredients. And there was some final marvellous moment when a chinless wonder of a young man was standing by the front door. Say, excuse me, but I'm looking for Wren Hoodrum Flip-Hop. And I said to him, hold your tongue, you insolent young puppy. This is my finest hour. And the chin disappeared into the neck then, absolutely. It was a wonderful moment.
Wonderful.
But we did have a lot of fun.
You had to, because your actual working conditions, it was so monotonous, I imagine.
So monotonous and hot and uncomfortable. And food was pretty nasty. But
I think that's what a lot of the ladies that we speak to remember, whether they're crossus operators like you were or bomb operators.
Yes.
It's the environment that they were in.
Yes.
That's what they remember, you know,
absolutely.
How hot it was, all the lights, how dreadful the lights were.
They were. But we were in the Newmanry, as it was called. We were treated with not familiarity, but great respect, and that made it all very much easier. And, of course, girls are gregarious by nature, and we're all great friends.
And I bet you kept those friends for life, didn't you?
Yes, many of them. Many of them.
This is what all of our ladies say.
You were
thrown together.
Yes.
And it was like a family, wasn't it?
It was like a family, and it was a crucial moment. Many girls came straight from school. As I said, I'd been to university, so I was that much older.
Mm.
But getting away from mum and fetching the fish on Tuesday and all the stuff you do at home, you know.
A lot of ladies say to me it was a big adventure.
That's right.
Because obviously for yourself, you'd been to university, you'd left home, but a lot of the girls hadn't left home, had they?
Hadn't left home, honestly. And there were some who were more innocent than you'd believe possible. One little 17-year-old, you know, really didn't know what men for, she said.
And did you ever sneak out and get down to London or things like that?
All the time, yes.
Did you?
Yes. The dodge was to find a stopping train, one that was followed fairly quickly by another, so you could stop at one of the little stations on the way to London, I forget what they were called, or on the way to Oxford. One called Parsley Hay I used to use on the way to Oxford. And you had to make sure there was another train coming along behind. You got out, you changed out of your uniform, you stuffed it in the manger, put on your glad rags, which you brought in a plastic, or the equivalent of a plastic bag, and went up to London all glamorous for your evening out. But of course it depended on being certain that on the way back the same operation could be repeated.
There was ladies that came back on the milk train, weren't there?
Straight into work,
park,
yes, absolutely.
And looking a little bit too glamorous for
yes,
a day.
Yes, absolutely, but luckily, a lot of the officers had no idea what we got up to. It was part of the fun, really.
And do you look back, in general, that it was fun?
I look back that it was fun, and I look back at the fact that whatever other nonsense I'd made, I did once do something valuable for my country.
Your service was invaluable, and thank you so much for your service.
Well, you know, it was lucky that we came to such an unusual and really rather sparkly place, even though we weren't allowed to see much of it. It was fun being here. The vibes were very good.
Now, for this final selection, slightly longer than the other interviews, we're going back to 2016. What myself and our original host, Catherine Lynch, wanted to do in that episode was focus on one of our oral history volunteers. They're an amazing bunch of people, and they go around the country interviewing our veterans so we can save their stories for generations to come. So on what I remember was, I think the hottest day of the year, we met David Stern, one of these volunteers, as he went to go and interview Jeannie Cotchie and her daughter Linny as well. What's wonderful about this interview, and I know both Catherine and myself were really proud of this, is that we get to tell a lady that she did do something important in the war.
I'm in the midst of typing up your story at the moment, and it's fascinating, all the things that you've told me.
Really?
Oh, yeah. You get a chance to correct it for me.
I probably won't think it's me, some other person. It haunts me, though. When I think of Bletchley, it does haunt me. Especially going up that lovely drive for the first time from Crawley Grange. We were told from London, when we weren't typists or nurses or cooks or weren't any use to them, we were going to go on special duties. And it was the best quarters the Wrens have had in the whole country. So that was nice. And we got in a coach and we went into North Crawley, turned into a drive, and this gorgeous house. I thought, they're right. Are we going to be here? It's a beautiful house. And from there, we went daily into the park for training. But I thought I was going to live there, of course. But I was only there while I was trained. I was so sorry to leave it.
Where did you go from there?
From there I went to Wavendon House.
And what was that like?
Quite a nice house. And it has a lovely lake and tennis courts.
Am I right in thinking that if you're in lovely surroundings for your accommodation, that's great, but a bit of a contrast with the work itself?
Oh, well, that was it. That was the thing that hit me hard. We weren't aware that they were concentrating on camouflage all the time. Camouflage, camouflage. So they wouldn't have a lot of Wrens together or a lot, you know, it was a very sort of broken up. A huge kitchen was there for the Wavendon people living there. People fed us. But the actual huts we worked in were out of the kitchen. I remember walking across a lane and these little row of cottages, and between the cottages was a passageway into a wood, and the huts were hidden in the wood. And probably, looking back, that was why they chose Wavendon, because it had, you know, camouflage woods around them.
That it had to not look important from the sky, didn't it?
Exactly. And of course, the camouflage was ugly, but you couldn't make the house look bad. It was quite a nice house.
There was a whole belt all around the home counties of these houses taken over, weren't there?
Oh, yes, there were. I wanted to know from you, didn't I, if they went to Woburn House, because it was a lovely programme on Woburn House. And I know Wrens went there, but I didn't know whether they worked there.
A good number of them were billeted there.
Billeted there.
But they were the ones that would be bussed in every day to Bletchley.
Yes, yes.
They tell me it was freezing.
Was it? Oh, at Woburn Abbey.
At Woburn Abbey. It wasn't comfortable at all. And so they had a tea urn. When you came off a shift, rather than drink the tea, you didn't waste it on drinking it. You put it in your hot water bottle because it was so cold.
For
the best. So I think even though the work was grim, if your accommodation was comfortable, I think you were fairly lucky.
Mm.
Do you remember it being cold, Mum?
No, I don't remember, darling. I can't remember.
Did you make some friends that you stayed in touch with later?
Well, one or two. I had the list from you kindly sent me. I couldn't really recognise anybody because I honestly didn't. We didn't keep up with them because I was sort of invalided out of Wavendon. I got so tearful and wasn't eating, so I was useless.
Was that the shift pattern, do you think, how tiring it was?
Yes. Well, that and the loneliness of it at nights, working through the night alone. I had perhaps somebody come in would give me a sheet of what to, you know, to put all the things in the right place.
Menu,
yes. But said hello and went out again. I signed a form there'd been. And then I was left on my own. And I'd had such a super few years before I would join the Wrens that I loved company, and I was brought up in a school. So, you know, working on my own was horrid.
It was a shock, I should think.
At night, too, when you're normally in bed asleep, you know.
Your mind does
funny
things to
you. You'd sort of sit there waiting for it to stop, and it would all stop. So you had to take everything off, get the papers out, look at the menu, put the next slot up, you know, and then press the button, get it going, then sit down again and wait for it to go. Round it went, you know. And you looked at it must be dawn soon, and you looked at it was sort of 11:30 or something, you know. You said, oh, no.
Nothing drags like a night shift, does it? Did you used to do a whole week of nights at a time? Do you remember? It was quite grueling, wasn't it?
It would have been a week.
Were you not paired up on the bomb? Were you talking about working on your own? I've not heard of that before.
No,
it's not.
I think that would have that's important. I've picked that up from what Jeannie has told me too. Mm. Our understanding usually was that the wrens acted in pairs. And the reason it's had such an effect on Jeannie was that she was on my own. Quite so.
She
worked 8-hour shifts in the woods.
Not funny.
One bomb per hut. Entirely on her own for 8 hours through the course of the night with these hot smokes.
People would come with the menu 2 or 3 times in the night, but you know, you weren't on the right wavelength from working from midnight to 8 in the morning. You know, you're usually in bed asleep, so it was hard to be awake anyway. It was odd.
So how did you come to be invalided out? Did you get so that you just felt poorly and couldn't
I was it? I went off food, and I was getting just low and tearful, and I don't know whether they'd had it before, but I had my bicycle up there, I think, and they sent me to a lovely, lovely family doctor in the village about 2 miles away. And I cycled there, and I think he summed me up straight away that I was exhausted, and he recommended this girl should be sent to an outdoor job immediately. That's when I went down to Sheerness, in the mail office, in the dockyard, chatting up all the sailors.
That sounds better.
Better than being in the woods on your own at night, isn't it?
Well, we had a boat and an old crew of two real old sailors, lovely old boys, who used to take us out into the harbour of Sheerness when ships came in. And were we popular? We had all their mail on board, and we had the mail to pass to them alongside the ship, you know, huge ship. And out of one porthole there would come a glass, and out of the other probably a gin and tonic to pass to me in the boat alongside with the mail. That was lovely. We went aboard sometimes too. And then we had a minesweeping one that went. We had a boat called Tudno, St. Tudno, but it was Tudno, down the river, that was, it was stationary. I mean, it was, you know what I mean?
Moored.
Moored, thank you, Linny. And it had an office on board for all the minesweepers. And, of course, they were sort of old-school public schoolboys, you know. And having been to a boys' school, I was perfectly at home with them. And it was lovely taking their mail and having a little tot of rum and having a chat. I told you all this, didn't I?
You did.
It sounds like
was magic.
A good time.
That was where she met her husband.
Aha, plenty of young men to choose from.
The minesweepers were mostly RNVR, sort of public school boys. And it was fun going aboard with their mail. It was lovely. It was nice.
It must have felt like going home after growing up in a boys' school.
Oh, it was. It was lovely. And I had a lovely, funny old van. I used to pick up the mail from the mail office in Sheerness and drive to Minster and places on the island with the mail. Of course, you were so popular as soon as you arrived because they knew what they brought you. But it was the latter part on the Isle of Sheppey was lovely. And the town was nice. It was bubbling with wrens and RAF and all sorts of WAFs and service people. I went over to Laysdown halfway. We used to go over to Minster, where there was an Air Force delivering there. At the far end of it, there were two old girls that had a huge bungalow, and they entertained all the service people that went there. They got so tiddly, two old girls, they got so tiddly. They used to feed us. We'd take drink with us because it would be off round ration. And they'd make us so welcome. We'd have such a real sort of civid evening, which was magic to go to. Well, you see how vivid my memory is. 94, it's as clear as a bell. A lovely photographic memory, which is great, because I can see all the good things apart from the bad. My dad didn't talk about the First World War at all. I've learnt an awful lot since. I found photographs of the Cameron that was sunk in the Mediterranean, and he was taking out a group of men to Bombay. And they were torpedoed, and he had to sort of jump in the water with the last young man that couldn't swim. And all that, you know, he lost a lot of them. And he got picked up and taken to Malta. And from Malta, they got him back. It must have been horrifying. And that's why when he was a headmaster of a boys' school, the only thing he would expel a boy from school was when they went to the swimming baths to push another boy in. They were taught never push another boy in the water.
I think there are some defining moments in your life, aren't there, that things that then shape the rest stay with you. And
yeah.
maybe those horrible nights alone in the woods in that hut have stayed with you?
Well, so much happened afterwards when I left, you know, the whole of Bletchley Park behind me, which I wasn't fit for, really. We were sent there because we weren't any use to, in other ways. I wasn't a nurse, I wasn't a cook, I wasn't this, I wasn't that. So it was an open field. They just sent, well, were sent at, she's had a good schooling or been to a good school, were sent her to Bletchley.
It's more the opposite.
I think they were looking for certain qualities. They seem to get...
Well, yes.
They'll have been observing you during basic training without you realising.
Oh, that wouldn't have done me any good, because when I was helping in the kitchen, they had a huge machine that was feeding the whole of the people in the building, the students and the staff, and we put the potatoes in and pressed the button, and off it went, peeling the potatoes. And I stopped it, and it all went all stuck all on over the ceiling because I pressed it the wrong time.
And they put you on pioneering technology that we were relying on to find the U-boats.
We discussed the selection. You were saying that they asked you if you were keen on crosswords or puzzles, and none of which you were.
Yeah.
But then you told me that you felt that your selection was because you were a public school girl.
Yes.
And also because you were the only girl in an entire boys' public school.
Yes.
So it had a sense of independence and spirit about her.
Mm.
That's what you said to me, remember?
Mm.
Do you think that's probably what swung it?
Probably.
Nobody really knows why they were picked. Mm. It's all guesswork, isn't it? But it's interesting, isn't it, to think about what
stood you out. I think
they're
glad to get rid of me, really. I loved squadrille, you know, all that. I loved all that movement. But when I had to scrub the chief officer corsets, I didn't fancy that.
Scrubbing corsets?
Mm.
Good grief. But you were scrubbing the chief officer's corsets?
Yes, in her private flat.
Had you done something wrong?
Hampstead Training Centre.
Was this a punishment?
Oh, no, I think probably an honour.
You were saying that you weren't good enough to be a nurse or something else. They gave you a job at Bletchley. At that time, that was the most important role you could have had in the Wrens, because you were a Wren special duty.
That's right.
So you were more important than any of those other Wrens.
Oh, my headmistress told me I was fit for nothing.
You were one of the select few.
The elite.
But no, we just want you to realise that you were special. It was a very select few that were selected.
There'd be something about you that was picked out as a different.
Absolutely. Of all of the different duties you could have been given in the Wrens, yours was the most special.
You were entrusted with something very important. Looking a little bit more recently to when you approached about the oral history project and asked to share your memories, what did you think? Did you like the idea? Did you think it seemed odd that somebody would be so interested in
meeting people. I love meeting people. It was fine.
Did you find that you remembered more than you thought you did when you started talking about it?
Yes, it does revive things in your memory. Yes, I think it does. Yes.
Of course, you put it all away in cold storage, as you said yourself, didn't you?
Yes.
So it all sat dormant for a while.
Yes, I don't ponder on the dark times.
No.
Too many lovely things have happened since.
Good, good.
Mm.
In this particular instance, Jeannie and I are friends. Linny Arriva and I are friends. Linny is Jeannie's daughter. And it came out quite by accident in conversation at a small reunion that they had a few weeks ago that Linny's mother worked at Bletchley Park. And, of course, my sister-in-law said, oh, my brother-in-law works at Bletchley Park too. And one thing has led to another.
Mm.
So I got in touch with the oral history department, Jonathan Byrne, and said, look, I've found another one. Can we do it? And although it's a little bit out of my catchment area, I begged to do this particular one because such a nice lady and we're friends. And that's how it came about.
There's lots of different people who are doing different jobs in different locations around the country and around the world. Does it feel like you're part of something bigger than you realised at the time, perhaps? You get more of a sense of what the bigger picture was. And
oh, yes. You didn't realise it till you left Bletchley, really.
Did you ever discuss any of your wartime work with Alan, your husband? Because he was in the Navy too. Did you discuss it with him?
Not really, because he didn't discuss what he did to me.
Mm.
We went through sort of civvy life and having a family of three and him getting going in business and sport. He was a great sportsman. And I was glad to pick up the things I liked, like amateur dramatics and things. I was destined for the stage anyway.
Well, you tried the boards before the war, didn't you, for
yes.
a while?
Mm.
No wonder being on your own didn't sit so well.
No, have an audience. Exactly.
It's interesting just how important colour and vibrancy and life, if you like, is to you.
Yeah.
And so for me, so very easy to understand why in the dismal, dark bomb rooms,
thank you.
It would have had such a dreadful effect.
I know.
I find that very easy to understand.
Yes, I expect you do.
So few people do understand that, and that's important to tell that story.
David, turning to you, obviously you get to come and bask in all the detail of these lovely stories.
Yes, it's a huge privilege. I never thought I would end up doing this as a voluntary job after I retired. And I've managed to swing it that I could interview 26 now to date. And I also transcribe other people's interviews. So I've done, I think, 27 of those to date. So what's that, 53? 53 in total. So by now, I'm building up this huge picture, at least in my mind, of what the veterans did. But to answer your question more fully, yeah, it is an absolute privilege. Huge privilege. I've thoroughly enjoyed it.
It's a few years that fit into the whole tapestry of someone's life. The war changed everything for everyone that was involved in it and lived through it. Everything became, you know, before and after. It's an important chapter in the life of everyone that lived through it. So you couldn't pick six other years in someone's life and say, well, you know, how did that shape the rest of your life? In quite the same way.
You are absolutely right. You know, it's remarkable. All the people that we speak to, by definition, were in very much their formative years. They're all sort of 17 and a half, 18, 19, very impressionable. So when they were told on pain of death that, you know, this was the Official Secrets Act and you will say nothing, otherwise you're likely to be shot, they took that very, very seriously. Mm-hmm. And that carried through many of them till they left us and never told us what they did.
Mm-hmm.
So you're absolutely right. It's a pivotal time in their lives. It would be a pivotal time in anyone's life. And they're all, including you, my dear, all so self-effacing. All think that, well, we didn't do much. We only just turned a few cogs or a few wheels. But sometimes it's my privilege to be able to say, just as you've done, you did far more than that. You did a great deal.
Oh, well.
It's important that the information is there for archivists and historians and authors and students and anybody who would want that. But it's additionally important for us at Bletchley Park so that we can make the experience more authentic, that it's absolutely true to what it was when you were there, so that visitors will get to understand and realise and appreciate and respect what you did.
Mm.
And I also find that it's important, once the story is finished, to be able to give a copy back to the family and have a copy of the sound recording as well. And that's something that will last for generations.
It's
a threefold benefit for what we do. And I get an enormous kick out of doing this.
Your story is fascinating. Thank you very much for sharing it with us. I hope it brings you some pleasure to think that it's captured in a lasting way now, and that when years and years from now people want to learn about what happened in intelligence in the Second World War, your story will be part of that.
Oh, well, simple as it was, of course, but just a cog in the wheel.
Thank you.
Pleasure to have you. I'm sure you're ready for some refreshment.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes.